Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. On the show this morning, we are talking about the tentative federal approval for the Lake Powell pipeline, the pressure that a uranium mining company put on the Interior Department to get the Bears Ears National Monument shrunk, the proposal for a sizable increase in education funding in the governor's proposed budget, and more. And joining me to discuss these stories, Salt Lake Tribune health, education, and environment editor Tony Semerad. Tony, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Environment reporter Emma Penrod is with us as well. Good morning, Emma, and welcome.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
And also here in studio is news columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning, Robert, and welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
As always, you can join us with your questions and comments. You can post those at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us up. We are at 801-355-8255. Emma, let's start with you, actually, in something that you've been following for several years now, the story of state plans for a water pipeline. Actually, you've been following a couple of proposed pipelines, actually. This story that you wrote this week is about the Lake Powell pipeline and the tentative go-ahead the federal government has given to that project. Before we get to that part, a quick refresher to start with. This is a proposed project to move water from Lake Powell to where?
It would be up to Sand Hollow Reservoir, just east of St. George would be where the water would end up. It would be providing water for 13 communities in the southwestern part of the state, primarily in St. George and Washington County and Kane County.
And it's slated to be a pretty expensive project as well.
The current numbers put it somewhere in the range of $1.1 to $1.8 billion.
Okay. And then, as I said, it has tentative federal approval. Who gives, or I guess who is giving that approval, and then why is it tentative?
Well, so this is kind of a tricky thing. They need approval from, you know, like dozens of regulators of BLM, Forest Service, National Parks. But the first place they have applied is with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. And they applied to them because they plan to install several hydroelectric turbines on the pipeline's route, which means that they need a hydroelectric operating license before they can open up, among other things that they need. So they applied to FERC initially because they were hoping that FERC would be kind of the lead agency on this project. And the idea was that FERC would, you know, take all the information they gave to FERC, and after they, you know, drafted this license, they would also produce all the environmental analysis and documentation that was then needed to acquire all the subsequent permits.
And so, as you reported, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they have approved this part of this, the hydroelectric part, but they're saying essentially, hey, this is the part that we can approve, but maybe we can't approve the rest of it. Can you explain what that means for this project?
Yeah, what they've done is they've approved the license application. So they've said, okay, we deem this application to be complete and ready for further analysis. And so at this point, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be asking for public comment as we consider all of the environmental impacts and other things that would be associated with this project so that we can determine what conditions would be put in the license upon it being granted. But then they added this interesting little language where they did say, you know, we don't actually know for sure whether we have jurisdiction over this whole project. We might only have jurisdiction over the hydropower portion of this project. So we're going to be evaluating our jurisdiction, too.
Okay. So they'll evaluate that jurisdiction. If they find that they don't have that jurisdiction and aren't going to proceed, you know, going through the rest of that process, the environmental analysis, et cetera, who will do that?
So then that means that it's going to give, I guess, more power, one could say, to these other permitting agencies, where instead of, you know, FERC kind of being the go-between, what's going to happen is these agencies are going to have a more direct role in the permitting process, which means that the information that the state has provided may be subject to other criteria that maybe initially state regulators maybe weren't thinking they were going to have to deal with.
More hoops for the state to jump through,
yes.
Essentially. State water officials, state water planners, I guess, are still pretty excited about the fact that they got this initial approval, though, right?
It is a significant step forward. for their project. There was, you know, it's been delayed already. They actually submitted this application over a year ago, and it's just been this ongoing process to try to fill in some holes, correct errors that were in the documentation, as well as just to answer these questions that FERC keeps, you know, coming back to the state with, you know, about the financing of the pipeline, how it's going to be paid for, you know, more information they've asked for on water data. There wasn't much more information to give them, but FERC did ask for that. They've also, I understand that the ultimate hangup was actually a report on the cultural resources that are in that area. This pipeline will be going, depending on which route is ultimately selected, either through or just around a Native American reservation in that area. There's several, you know, sacred sites and ruins and that kind of thing in the path of the pipeline. And it has been an ongoing effort that the state has had to deal with to try to document all of those and show, you know, what mitigation could be done perhaps to try to avoid them. I haven't seen that documentation. It's all confidential. But I know that that was the final bit of information, according to FERC, that ultimately, once they received it, they decided to accept the application.
Okay. And again, the plan is to pump it out of Lake Powell to a high point. And that high point is actually just inside of what was Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That is my understanding.
And then it will drop from there to these various, well, wherever it goes. I mean, wherever they mm-hmm. want to put the water from there. You reported that a fear expressed by someone, a critic of this pipeline, an opponent, this is Zach Frankel with the Utah Rivers Council, and we can get to his sort of general objections in a second, but you reported about his worry that FERC's approval could actually be the last word here, that maybe those other agencies won't necessarily have to get involved. Can you explain that?
I don't know. There's no way FERC's approval will be the last word. No matter what happens, there will be other agencies that will have to issue permits for this pipeline to be built. That said, his concern was that they could get the go-ahead from FERC based on FERC's criteria for the need and purpose of the pipeline. Need and purpose is a really important requirement that has to be satisfied whenever an agency is, you know, awarding any kind of a permit. It has to be demonstrated that, you know, the project is needed, not just something that we're building just because, before we decide that it's worth having some kind of impact on the environment or whatever the case may be. And, you know, Zach's concern was that FERC may only look at the need and purpose with respect to hydroelectric power, in which case maybe they only look at demand for hydropower. Is it there? Could they sell it? And those kinds of things, rather than assessing whether or not the water is actually needed, which is something that Zach and others do not believe to be true.
And that's actually, maybe I'll bring Robert Gerke in on this as well, because he, in a column, wrote about this. The amount of data that we have on how water is used is a little bit murky in the state of Utah.
Yeah, murky's putting it mildly, I guess. So this week there was an audit that came out by the legislative auditor. And it was sort of an update of an audit that came out in 2015. And that 2015 audit said that water districts don't know how much water they use. And because they don't know how much they use, they don't know how much they're going to need. And the monitoring is not good. They can't quantify how much they've saved or how much they could save through conservation efforts. And so the audit that came out just this week was an update of that and said, basically, that's still the situation. They've made some progress toward quantifying the use, but they don't have a good grasp of the needs. And so to even be pursuing this Lake Powell pipeline when we don't know what the needs are going to be, what we can get through conservation, what we're using now, I think is it's premature. And then, you know, there's also this question of how you pay for it. As Emma mentioned, the estimates are anywhere from $1.1 to $1.8 billion. But those are old estimates, and they're based on and when we look at how much they've spent on a similar pipeline in Colorado, they spent close to $1 billion on a pipe that covers about a third of the distance, doesn't go up 2,000 feet and back down. Doesn't have all these pumps, doesn't, you know, and so to be sort of plowing headlong into this when we don't know the cost, we don't know the need, we don't know how much we can save through conservation, there's not a plan for repayment, is kind of foolhardy. And the governor in his budget that came out this week had some good language, some good rhetoric, I guess, about how we need to go slow on this and we need to answer those questions. But despite the governor saying that we need to answer those questions, his water division is still pursuing this without without having good answers to any of that. And it seems like we're putting the cart before the horse on this.
Yeah, and you, I mean, in your column, you issue a call to the governor to kind of hit the brakes on it. Emma or Robert, for that matter, why don't we know how water is being used? I mean, what are the obstacles to our understanding how water is used in the state?
Well, because the way we're using it is kind of changing. We've always, you know, a lot of the agricultural water that has traditionally been used to water crops is kind of being taken out of circulation because we're losing farmland, you know, moving toward a more urban setting. And so that uses less water. Part of it is because we have this sort of scattered patchwork of water districts that have varying quality, I guess, in terms of how they monitor it. Metering is a big issue because, you know, one of the things the legislature has told districts to do is to, you know, meter the water because, frankly, when you meter the water, people start being a lot more efficient about it. Mm. But it's been inconsistent on implementation of that. And so there's also, we don't know how much there's leakage is a big issue on these water systems. They don't know, they can't quantify that. And so, yeah, there's just a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of variables, I guess, when you're trying to gauge something like that.
Emma Penrod, does that seem the same? I mean, I imagine you would give a similar response as to why we don't know where water is going.
The metering is a huge issue. Although, you know, most household use maybe is metered. I mean, everyone has a little meter and they pay a water bill. There is this issue of secondary water use. Secondary water use is used throughout the state, in some areas of the state, to water lawns, gardens, those kinds of things. But it's also how almost all agricultural water is used, which is to say that most agricultural water is not necessarily metered at this point. It is estimated that 80% of water used in Utah is used for agricultural purposes. Of course, it's not metered, so that's a nice estimate. And so there's a very large portion of water in Utah that isn't monitored or metered at all. Of the roughly 20% that is metered and is monitored because it's residential and commercial water use, there are issues with getting them to report that data to the state. When the data is reported to the state, it is often reported inaccurately, which has forced some, you know, state agencies to have to try to go through a laborious process in order to correct and or fill in any, you know, holes that exist in this, you know, data that they've received. And the result of this process is that the vast majority of water data in Utah is not actually based on any data collected at all, but is in fact actually based on educated guesses being made by state scientists.
Okay. I'm sorry, this is so weedy, but I want to get into it. Why would the data be reported inaccurately? Is it to anyone's benefit to make that data inaccurate?
There's probably a variety of reasons why that's happening. Some of it is likely due to just a lack of uniformity. Some, you know, water agencies use one series of units, whereas, you know, there might be another kind of unit being used by another water agency, and so then the units have to be converted to be proper. There's disagreement about what water ought to be counted and why. You know, as Robert pointed out, there's an issue with, you know, some places don't account for leaks. They only, you know, account for the water that's actually being used and metered at the site of use, at the home, at the business that's using it. So they're not accounting for water that may be leaking out or sent to the house and never gets there.
Okay.
There is also a very real chance that these numbers are being purposely, you know, messed up. There are water agencies that purposely overreport, I have been told, their water use in order to, in their minds, secure their water rights in the state. If they don't use the water, they potentially lose their water rights, is their fear. So they report that they are using more water than they are actually using.
As right. a way to claim it, sort of.
Right. You gotta hold on to the water you've got. Holding on to water, it's tricky, but water's a valuable commodity here in the West. The old saying is we drink our whiskey and fight over water. By inflating the numbers, you can make a claim that those those water rights are existing, they're valid, they've been, and if you don't use the water, you lose the water. Mm-hmm. And so by saying they're using the water, they hold on to it longer, and it's worth a lot of money. You don't want to let all that money flow downstream. And so, yeah, there is an incentive, I guess, to sort of spitball the numbers and go high instead of go low.
There is an issue, too, with some water agencies just have in the past at least outright refused to report their water data to the state for likely similar reasons. There was recently a penalty created by the state so that these water systems that refuse to do so can be penalized and punished if they choose not to report to the state as they are required to do.
Well, in the second driest state in the nation, you would think we would have better accounting for our water.
This is a west-wide problem. It's not just Utah.
Okay. I want to just circle back. We have to move on to other topics, but for a quick moment to the Lake Powell pipeline that we began with is supposed to be paid for. How does the state expect to pay for the $1.1 to $1.8 billion?
We're going to have a bake sale.
You have a whole 2 hours to discuss this, right?
Yeah. Unfortunately not. In a nutshell?
State law says that the state will pay for the construction and all research and permitting of the project, and then Washington County and Kane County Water Conservancy districts will use the sale of the water and the electricity generated by the pipeline and to pay off that debt. So the price of the water is not yet determined, but the water will be sold at a rate that will allow the state to reimburse itself over the course of approximately 50 years. That's what the state law has to say on the issue.
Yeah, and so what it means for those users in Kane and Wasatch or Washington County, well, let's speak specifically to Washington County, they're going to see a huge increase in their water rates because they've got to be the ones that are going to be paying back the state for this. I think tripling is sort of the number that they've told FERC that they anticipate that it's going to triple water rates. There's going to be a sharp increase in impact fees. So whenever you build a house, you're going to have to pay for a lot of money up front. And it's going to be a dramatic increase in the cost for those people living down there, if you believe they're actually going to repay it, which frankly, I kind of have questions about whether they'd ever actually be able to repay it anyway in a realistic economic sense.
Well, if they're trying to drive growth, drive a whole bunch of new people moving into the area by forcing water down there, maybe with that the population.
Well, that's
spike.
That's the notion is that they're growing rapidly. But again, it goes back to the question of what do we have, how much do we have, how much can we save? I mean, the water use in Washington County, they told FERC, is about 325 gallons a day per person. Is that right, Emma?
That's what they
told FERC, which is about twice the national average. It's about 100 gallons more a day per person than what Las Vegas uses. Huh. So there's a lot of room there. If that's their actual usage, there's a lot of room there for conservation to play into this. And maybe we do need Lake Powell, but maybe we don't need it in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. Maybe it's a 50-year project. And then you can start start planning to pay it back.
Emma, last question here. FERC is taking public comment on this right now, right? I mean, this is something that they've said you can weigh in on.
Yeah, FERC, they're looking for input from the involved agencies as well as from the public on what maybe some conditions or some thoughts on, how best to regulate this project. Those comments can be submitted online on FERC's website. There's a link in our story on our site. It's kind of convoluted, easier to find it online.
At sltrip.com.
Yes. Yeah. And then that is due in early February. It's 60 days from when they accepted this on Tuesday.
Okay. Actually, I have one more question. Could this project suddenly start moving along really quickly if FERC, for example, does take a bigger role than maybe they're expected as this critic of the pipeline contends could happen conceivably?
That could happen, possibly.
Okay.
but at this rate, the project is moving somewhat slowly. They have a lot more legwork to do. Okay. And we'll just have to see if they can make up for the delays.
Okay, well, we will keep watching, and we'll keep watching the Bear River Pipeline, another big infrastructure project as well. But right now, we've got to go to our first break of the show. And when we come back, we'll turn to a follow-up from last week having to do with the Bears Ears National Monument. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, joined by Salt Lake Tribune Health, Education, Environment editor Tony Semerad, reporters Benjamin Wood and Emma Penrod, and news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news wrap-up. You can join us with your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. A follow-up now to something that we covered last week on the show, the action that President Donald Trump took on national monuments in Utah. And Tony Semerad, there was a story in the Tribune this week about some pressure that was put on the Interior Department by a specific interest to try to get the Bears Ears National Monument shrunk. Who are we talking about here?
Okay, well, this we turned up correspondence from a company called Energy Fuels Resources based in Colorado. And during the sort of big, thick comment period where Interior was taking comment about these monument rescissions, this company weighed in privately, from what we can tell, wasn't part of the public comment, to basically urge rescissions to the monument that they felt would protect their assets down there. They're one of the last remaining uranium processors in the country. They operate this mill down in White Mesa. And they were worried about the impact of the monument on resources they have just outside the monument. So it's sort of on the periphery of the way the monument was defined.
That's part of it, right? I mean, I saw that they have a uranium mill just outside of the monument, and this is the country's last operating uranium mill. Did I read that right?
And even that's a little sort of nuanced. Emma's reporting has sort of looked into what that mill does, and the definition of uranium processing is kind of interesting in that regard.
Emma, you want to jump in? I mean, is it essentially that is it to be continuously operating for it to be a processing plant?
Well, the company does assert that it's the last operating uranium mill. That's something that they like to say. Mm-hmm. They do occasionally or have been on standby for periods of time when there's not enough ore to be milled. They're also not necessarily always milling uranium ore. They accept a kind of product called alternative feeds, which are uranium-containing materials that they then run through their mill to extract the uranium from, and then they put the remaining waste product in their tailings cells.
Okay. So they might not meet everybody's definition of what a mill actually does.
Yes.
And they also, Tony, they also made, I mean, so you mentioned that they talked about their interests outside of the monument during this public comment period, though their comments may have been private. They also made a case that's kind of similar to something the Utah State Legislative Commission on Federal Public Lands, I can't think of their name. Maybe that's it. Federal Public
Commission
Lands.
On the Stewardship of Public Lands.
Yeah. Thank you. They made having to do with national security, and the argument was about access to uranium in the area.
Yeah, it was really kind of a twofold argument that they made in this May 25th letter. They're urging America's sort of energy independence, which has, of course, been a theme of the Interior Department as it approaches these issues with regard to public lands. They also kind of argued for reducing American reliance on foreign sources for uranium and kind of made a national security argument, if you will, in that regard.
Representative Rob Bishop, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, and others have said that that there aren't mineral resources in what was the Bears Ears National Monument that are worth anything. Representative John Curtis, in fact, only a month into his term, has introduced a bill that would, among other things, withdraw minerals, prohibit essentially mining from the area inside the previous monument boundaries. But I guess we're not talking about uranium in that instance, or are we?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely some nuances to parse there. Secretary Ryan Zinke, Rob Bishop, and others have been very insistent that this isn't being driven by oil and gas development, that this was more of a, you know, reservations about the Antiquities Act and how it had sort of been politicized as a, you know, as a piece of legislation. This would seem to be kind of a countervailing, you know, piece of evidence here. This company was sort of weighing in, arguing for the value of these uranium resources. And, you know, whether that's related to energy extraction or not, right. I guess I'd leave that up to the listener. But there was another interesting layer here that you know, Robert and Tommy Burr's reporting had sort of turned up, is that there's sort of this very eerie kind of similarity between what the Commission for Public Lands was urging and what Energy Fuels was urging. The correspondence that our reporters turned up from state leaders virtually echoed what Energy Fuels Resources was also saying. There's a very stark similarity there that would imply to us, at least, that Energy Fuels Resources also had the ear of state leaders, and state leaders were kind of advocating on their behalf.
Sort of coordinated comment period. Robert Kirky.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, none of this is surprising because you expect Energy Fuels to be advocating their interests. But I think what is interesting is the way they advocated their interest. This back channel emails to Senator Hatch, these meetings with Secretary Zinke's, I think, deputy chief of staff.
I think they even proffered maps at one point to Hatch.
They offered maps on what they wanted to see out of the monument through back channels to Hatch. And we only got these because they happened to share them with the governor's office. And then we grandmaed to the governor's office and they showed up. That's how we found out about those maps. They're not doing it the same way that the tribes were doing it, say, you know, they're not doing it the same way that some of the other ranchers were doing it. And you know, they did clearly have the ear of the state legislature. And another kind of interesting component of this is who they had making the case for them. And it's the deputy administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, who at the time was an executive or a lobbyist for this company. But now his nomination to be deputy director of the EPA is awaiting Senate confirmation. And so it's not like they had just sort of some, you know, they had special consideration given to them in this process. And as Tony mentioned, you know, there's not a lot of oil and gas in the monument as it was envisioned by President Obama, and there's less of it now, obviously, as it's envisioned by President Trump. But you know, there is this uranium, and it does look like they got some special consideration in trying to, you know, benefit this company.
You know, I don't know who this is a question for, but I'm thinking of the tribal advocacy for this monument. Doesn't the Navajo Nation in particular have a kind of troubled history with uranium mining? I mean, actually, on the Navajo Nation reservation, there are abandoned uranium mines that they are concerned about, and that might be a sore spot for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's to the point where the federal government over the years has paid reparations to some of the Navajo miners who were sickened by their work in the mills and in the mines. They were mistreated. They were misled about the risks of working in these mines and mills. And so the Navajo relationship historically with these uranium companies is, it's tragic. I mean, really, there's no other way around it. I mean, a lot of Navajo died and were sickened because of their work in these mines and mills, and they were told it was safe.
Mm. You know, court challenges to Trump's redesignation of the shrinking or whatever you want to call it,
yeah.
Of these monuments, that action that he took a couple of weeks ago is being challenged in the courts, is what I'm trying to say. And then there is legislation out there by Utah congressmen to try to undercut the lawsuits challenging that action by Trump. Does the letter from this group, from this uranium company, really mean all that much in the larger scheme of how this took place? Because it was obviously something that the Utah delegation and other interests wanted to see happen.
Yeah, I mean, probably not, just because we kind of all knew this was happening. And in the grander scheme of things, when the judges decide on the legality of shrinking the monument, or Congress decides on whether they want to see these lawsuits go away, the fact that energy companies had input on it probably is going to have very little bearing. Although it could point to a potential risk to the resources in the area, which could weigh into the, you know, because if there is actual intent to mine or drill or whatever, it does show that there is maybe an imminent risk to some of the resources in the area.
Isn't Tony Semmer, health education and environment editor, isn't the sort of standpoint of people like Representative Rob Bishop and the state that they are doing this is the work that they are engaged in or have been trying to do through things like the Public Lands Initiative or by advocating for the shrinking of these monuments is to protect it in the right way. Does this I don't know if you can answer this question, but does the connection to the uranium company run counter to that?
Well, I don't know. I think the public face, and especially when Trump came to town to kind of enact all of this, was sort of expand multiple use, you know, to sort of make these lands available for lots of different uses. But it has to be said that they've been very adamant that oil and gas development is not sort of part of that mix. It's more related to recreation and grazing and that sort of thing.
And they point to misinformation. They say that there's been kind of a misinformation campaign about Bears Ears, whereby the myth is that oil and gas exploration was going to happen there, and this was something that environmental groups were using to try and prop up the argument to advocate for the Bears Ears originally.
Right, and that's why I think I said it goes back to, you know, it does kind of show that if there's intent to actually do some mining and milling there. But I think, you know, you kind of teed it up a little bit. Can the state be trusted to manage these lands? I mean, the fact that they parroted these talking points from this energy group in their letter to Zinke kind of shows the control that these energy interests have over the state legislature. And so then why that's important is if you start looking at the legislation that's being sponsored by Congressman Stewart and Congressman Curtis, the boards that actually manage these lands are almost entirely made up of county officials, state officials, very little tribal input, very little environmental input. The federal input, the BLM, is an advisory agency, essentially, in the management of these lands. And so this is a de facto turnover of these areas to the state and to the counties. And so you know, then you step back and ask the question, well, who actually makes the decisions? Well, if it's the energy companies that are telling the state what to do, you're turning the land over to the energy companies at that point. And so, you know, you've got a real problem here in terms of who is actually going to be controlling the land and who has the best interest of the land at stake.
And in the meantime, we're waiting to see what happens with the legal challenges to Trump's action, also with this legislation, which would, you know, if it passes in both the House and Senate, it would make Trump's action.
It would get a congressional action is frankly the way this should have been handled all along. I mean, we've said that over and over. But yes, a congressional action on these monument boundaries would basically gut or nullify the legal challenges from the environmental communities and the tribes.
We'll see what happens. In the interest of time, though, we have to head on to other stories from this past week's news. And thanks again, Tony, for this update. Benjamin Wood, education reporter, over to you now. Earlier this week, Governor Gary Herbert unveiled his budget proposal for 2018, and there's a chunk of new tax revenue expected for next year. You report that Herbert wants to put the bulk of that new money into education. What kind of money are we talking about, and how would it fit into the education budget, Ben Wood?
Yeah, he's proposing something in the neighborhood of $200 million, a little over $200 million for K-12 schools, and then another 100 or so for higher ed. I mean, altogether, we're in the 300s of millions of dollars. And this is largely in keeping with the way Governor Herbert has rolled out his budgets over the last few years. He does tend to put a lot of eggs in the baskets of education.
Hmm. Would this be a one-time bump in funding for just next year, or would it be ongoing money?
This would be ongoing money. So this would be increasing per student spending. So the amount of money that follows a student to their various schools. So this would be, you know, lifting the education funding level by $200 or so million for elementary, middle school, high schools.
I'm just wondering, the extra money that we see in the budget this year, I don't know if we think of it as a windfall, but how would the increase be paid for in the future for education funding? Through what scheme?
Education funding is comes from the income tax, and it's largely a stable source of revenue. It tends to grow every year. At least, you know, the trends currently is that it grows every year. So they're fairly confident that, you know, the economy being what it is, this is money that will continue to be there next year, the year after that. We've seen these types of annual growth for the last few years. There is a little bit of one-time money thrown in for specific projects, but the bulk of what the governor's proposing is just naturally occurring income revenue for the state.
Got it. You wrote that $170 million would go to flexible local school money distributed to the districts, according, again, to this per pupil, this weighted per pupil unit. Weighted pupil unit is the word.
Yeah, per student spending. You can get into the weeds. But yeah, Essentially it's the money each kid gets.
Is it up to the districts to decide how their chunk of that $170 million would be spent?
It is. So what would happen is that, let's say you have Alpine School District. They have so many tens of thousands of students. The state essentially writes them a check, and then the Alpine Board of Education determines what to do with that. Most of that will go towards teacher salaries. That's the largest expense. From there, you have things like classroom technology, keeping the lights on, transportation, et cetera. But the big chunk is paying for the teachers in the classrooms.
Okay, so some, maybe some pay increases, and definitely probably some new teachers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Can we expect a lower student teacher ratio in classrooms?
Well, that's where it gets tricky. I mean, this is a lot of money, no doubt about it, but there's also a lot of students. The districts typically say that 2% WPU is just to break even on inflation. So what Governor Herbert is proposing is a 4%, and so you'd essentially have inflationary costs plus another $100 million or so divided among all the schools in the state. So probably a little bit of a raise, not a huge dent in the classroom size, though.
Not to rain on the governor's parade at all, but the Constitution requires the governor to put all of the income tax revenue that's generated into education. And so he didn't really have a whole lot of choice except to put all this money into education. But how he puts it in is important. As Ben mentions, giving it to the districts and letting them decide how to spend it, I think, is a good way to do it.
There's also $34 million in this per pupil spending for children at risk of academic failure. Who are those students, and why are they at risk, Ben Wood?
Yeah, so this is a new proposal that we're still working on the details for, but what the governor's proposing is creating a supplementary per student formula. So if you're a student who is locked in intergenerational poverty, you come from a low-income family, perhaps you're learning English as a second language, the typical demographics where we might see a student struggle, the governor's proposing that we fund schools based on how many of those students they have. So it would give a little bit of an extra bump for highly impacted areas.
You know, overall, in terms of our per pupil spending rate, will this move us up the list, you know, when you look at how states spend on students in any measurable way? I know people like to hear, did we go from 50 to, 47 or something like that, or wherever we are?
No. Our status as last in the nation will remain strong under this proposed budget.
Okay. What about the Our Schools Now initiative, which is that petition to increase funding for education through a tax? It would be about $700 million in additional funding for education. Is that still going forward?
It is going forward. Last I spoke to them, they're in the process of gathering signatures. They're fairly confident that they'll wrap that up either around the end of the year or in the early to mid new year. So they're expecting to push forward with that. They're gung ho.
What does the governor say about their initiative? I mean, given
very little.
Okay.
Governor Herbert, I think, is being very diplomatic. He has neither outright endorsed nor outright condemned. He's been threading the needle fairly carefully. He talks a lot about the need to support schools. He also talks about the concern of raising taxes.
Okay. He does say that it's good that they've put it on the radar and that it's encouraged a public discussion. I mean, I don't think you're going to see him come out and support it, but I also don't think you're going to see him take on the Gail Millers and Scott Andersons of the world and oppose it.
How does it's a broad question, but how does the legislature view this spending on education? Do their budget priorities align with the governor on this?
Well, to Robert's point, a lot of this money has to go to education one form or another. The governor tends to prefer flexible spending, which is often what the education community prefers as well. The legislature, they tend to take a more scalpeled approach where they say this much money to this project, that project. So what we tend to see is similar bulk funding levels. The dollars amounts are relatively equal because they have to be for the most part. But the legislature tends to take a more refined and tailored approach to funding specific priorities.
It seems like there's a bit of there usually is a bit of conflict between the legislature and the governor on the budget, right, Robert Kirky?
Yeah, but the legislature's sensitive to it. It almost turns into a competition where they feel like they have to come in somewhere close to what the governor's proposed in terms of the overall increase in education spending. They, as Ben mentions, they tend to like to manage the schools a little bit more and micromanage to the point where they're putting money into specific programs that they want. It does create a little bit of a competition. And again, they're bound by the same constitutional requirement that income tax dollars go to education. And so you will see a lot of money going to education because the income tax is the one tax in the state that's growing at a pretty healthy rate.
In a moment here, we're going to have to take a break. But Ben, we didn't talk about the impact of the proposed budget from the governor related to education and its impact on higher education in particular. Again, the bulk of the funding is for K through 12. But how will the money be spent in colleges and universities? According to the governor's budget.
Yeah, I mean, we see a similar type of flexible spending, but also the governor is prioritizing, I think it's something in the neighborhood of $8 million to sorry, I'm struggling to find the right wording here, to avoid a mandatory tuition increase. Because the way that the funding is laid out, schools are on the hook to match revenue to a certain extent by increasing tuition. But if they are able to cover those costs without raising tuition, then students can
afford to go.
Yeah, can afford to go a little bit better. So the governor is saying, let's put aside a little bit extra money to try and keep tuition from going up by the 1 or 2% that it goes up every year.
And what you usually see in higher ed especially is a lot of the money goes to buildings. I mean, and I think there were 4 or 5 buildings that were either at Applied Technology Centers or at the University of Utah that were at least got some money to be built, so or at least started. So yeah, that's the way a lot of the higher education money is.
Yeah, a corner of the budget announcement was Governor Herbert saying this is the year of the technical college. And so a lot of his budget does have specific areas related to technical education in the state's applied technology schools.
Including one building, I think, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah. Robert Gerke, there were a number of other things in the governor's proposed budget. $10 million for Operation Rio Grande that we already knew was coming. Another $10 million to improve the state park system. And then something that caught my eye was about $6 million to improve Olympic venues with an eye toward future bids on the Winter Olympics. Your general comments on the budget?
The $6 million was sort of a down payment on something that's going to be a longer-term effort, I think. The $10 million on Rio Grande is interesting. It's money that they're putting toward, you know, the later phases of this, you know, the rehabilitation and housing elements of it. The governor's budget was about what we expect to see, you know, and you know, one of the former legislative leaders joked to me once that he always appreciates a governor's budget because now his table is level, because they don't really put a lot of credence in what the governor recommends. It's nice. They appreciate his work, but they don't pay a lot of attention to it. But I do think one of the things that the governor hit on, and I talk about this in my column today, is the tax reform effort that he wants to see. And this is something the legislature's been looking at. Now, the governor is definitely getting invested in this because we do have a problem with the sales tax in this state, and something's going to have to be done. And our fuel tax is also a problem. And so that's where there's going to be a lot of discussion, I think, and the governor is going to be a key player in that coming up in this legislative session.
All right. And we will pay attention to that. And right now, though, we got to go to another break. When we come back, we will probably be turning to our underplayed stories of the week pretty soon. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Benjamin Wood, Tony Semerad, Emma Penrod, and Robert Gerke. You can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Ben Wood, let's squeeze in one more education story before we turn to our underplayed stories.
Yes, let's.
This has to do with an attempt in the legislature in 2016 to make school board elections partisan elections, which just means that that's an election with like an R or a D.
Right. You'd go through the convention system, et cetera.
Yeah. And then anyway, this change to elections for school board was met with a challenge leading to a judge's decision this week. What was the challenge about and what was this decision?
So the challenge was over a provision in the Constitution that says no partisan test can be used in determining, you know, employment in the public school system. So the plaintiffs were arguing that that prohibits a partisan election system for school board members. The state arguing that, you know, they're not employees and an election isn't a partisan test. The law doesn't say you have to be a Republican to be on the school board, whether or not that might be the intent of the law. But they were successful. The judge ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. And so right now, the election system, we presume, will be nonpartisan next year. We're still waiting to see how the state will respond.
You know, the original law, SB 78 from 2016, what was the problem that it was trying to fix?
The problem it was trying to fix is that our last election system got thrown out by the judge as well. So it used to be this really convoluted process with a committee and the governor and a nominating interview, et cetera. That got tossed up by the courts. The legislature responded by making a partisan election. That has now been challenged, and that election system is now in limbo. If the past is any predictor, it's all but certain we'll see some bills on this
In the upcoming session.
But I mean, the candidates are supposed to start filing in a month, and the session ends in March, and so it's an interesting timeline we're looking at now.
That is interesting. Tony Semerad, any comments on this? I mean, does this some of this might have to do with from what I understand, the governor's power in the past to nominate candidates.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my one observation would be, I think most Utahns kind of think of school board elections as nonpartisan. I think, and it'll be very interesting to see whether this legal ruling kind of holds up in terms of the employment aspect of it.
And if I could just pipe in, the reason I think it's good to have nonpartisan school board elections is we've seen what happens when you have candidates that have to go through the convention system, and the candidates that the parties nominate at the convention system are always the most right wing or the most left wing. They're not mainstream candidates, and so if you insert this partisanship, this corrupting influence of the convention system into partisan school board elections, you end up with a much more polarized, much more ideologically driven school board. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's what Utahns want. So I think this ruling by the judge is a good decision. I think it's good for Utah, and hopefully it stands up.
Okay, and about the makeup of the school board itself, Ben, is this a done deal? I mean, the state, as you said, is challenging it. We're just waiting to see, or they haven't decided if they're challenging.
Yeah, they have not decided. I've been checking in with them. If they determine whether they're going to appeal or not appeal, they've said they'd let me know, and we'll be updating.
I suspect you'll see a challenge to it, but then the question, like Ben mentioned, is you have these filing deadlines that are coming up. I think we'll probably see this next election cycle unfold under the existing regime without the partisan elections.
Yeah, we're so close to the session, too. I can't believe somebody's not going to weigh in.
Yeah, no. Definitely.
You'll get some comments. We'll know soon enough. Ben Wood, why don't we kick it off with you for Underplayed Stories of the Week. Do you have something picked out?
Yeah, our colleague had a story this week about an issue in Alpine School District where the district is looking at, in the process of rebuilding its schools, they're going to lump two together and close one. Sorry, I've got inversion throat this week.
Yeah.
It's been this contentious issue as parents, they hate to see their elementary school go away. But in the process, it's resurfaced this nascent talk of a school district split that's always been kind of in the background at Alpine School District. But it seems to be gaining a little bit more muscle this year than past attempts. So, people in Alpine District, they're starting to whisper and talk about dividing the district asunder.
Will it be ripped asunder? Will it happen? We'll see. Robert Gerke, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
You know, I think it was in today's paper, there's this ongoing battle between the right wing of the Republican Party and the party leadership over this SB 54 lawsuit. That this week, the members of the State Central Committee tried to call their own State Central Committee meeting where they can approve a contract with this wealthy individual to bankroll the rest of this lawsuit. The chairman and the vice chair of the party aren't able to attend. They can't call the party convention, but these State Central Committee members feel that they can call their own convention. So the party chairman is saying that whatever happens on Saturday doesn't matter. These right-wing people who want to continue this lawsuit are saying it does, and they're going to have the meeting regardless whether the chairman's there or not. It's absolute insanity. And so check that out, because, it's kind of nerdy and wonkish, but man, the drama is just
Game of Thrones.
You can't make it up. And also Brian Shiazawa, a longtime senator from Cottonwood Heights, announced his retirement this week.
Somewhat underplayed. Emma Penrod, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Well, so I'm not sure how this ended up being underplayed this week, but Utah is no longer the worst state for driving. according to this car insurance website, they analyzed traffic tickets and accidents and found that Utah is only the third worst state now.
Wow.
California apparently took the top spot.
Feel the change.
Right. Well, but if you've ever driven in Utah, you know this to be true, and you can validate this claim that this website made. The number one issue in Utah remains improper lane changes.
Not surprising. Tony Semmerhead, your pick for Underplayed.
Well, I am going outside the solar system for mine. I love this story about this immense black hole, 13.1 billion light years away. If the age of the universe were a 50-year-old man, this would be like looking at him when he was 2.5. Wow. There's a way in which astronomy is in kind of a renaissance period, if you ask me, all of these amazing questions being answered. And this is one of them.
Fantastic. For my part, I'm going to go with the fact that Crossroads Urban Center here in Salt Lake City wants to remake the Road Home Shelter downtown into a family shelter. As part of a city, county, state deal on homelessness, though, the Road Home is slated to be closed in 2019. There's also pressure from groups like the Pioneer Park Coalition, other interests in the area, to make sure that closure happens and that it sticks. Crossroads is saying, meanwhile, that there's a pending crisis for single mothers and their children. I'm just seeing a fight looming in the future. Check out Chris Smart's article at sltrip.com. Tony Semirad, Emma Penrod, Robert Gerke, and Benjamin Wood, all with Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks, as always, to KCPW's Jesse Ellis, to our partners at Utah Public Radio in Logan, who broadcast this show across the state. The list of people involved there includes Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. Thanks very much, you guys. And thanks and as well to the show's producer, Emily Means. Happy birthday earlier this week, Emily. Podcasts at kcpw.org of this show and all of our local programs. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Roger McDonough, and thanks once more for joining us here for Behind the Headlines every Friday morning at 9 a.m. And have a great weekend.